Well, I have always been fond of tongue twisters. As you've all come to know over the past 7 years, I'm somewhat of a talker. So I'm attracted to tongue twisters as a kind of agility test for my favorite skill. When I was a kid, my father would frequently challenge my sister and I with his favorite, a skunk sat on a stump, the stump said the skunk stunk, the skunk said the stump stunk, jump skunk jump. I myself have had many favorite tongue twisters over the years, from the classic, how much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood, to Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, some classics. Even the short but challenging red leather, yellow leather. I'm telling you, just do that over, it's a tough one. Red leather, yellow leather, tough, very tough. One of the most famous tongue twisters that I would guess most everyone in this room is familiar with and has tried at one time or another is, she sells seashells by the seashore. Yeah, of course, right? It turns out this is just the first line. Does anyone know the whole thing? Complete tongue twister? I didn't either. She sells seashells by the seashore. The shells she sells are surely seashells, so if she sells shells on the seashore, I'm sure she sells seashore shells. That's the complete. Now, one of the things I learned in seminary, looking at ancient texts and practices and trying to interpret their meaning centuries and millennia later, is that truth is often passed along through history in a concealed manner, especially when it runs counter to the powers that be, right? As we know, history is written by the winners. They like to write their version of it, as we were talking about earlier, especially men doing a lot of that writing. But that doesn't mean powerless people don't leave lots of secret information behind as well. When the Jewish people could not pass their history, language, and stories onto their children for fear of punishment from the ruling Romans, they created the dreidel and other practices that appeared to be frivolous games that actually continued to teach their tradition. Similarly, when enslaved Africans here in the south of this continent escaped their captors and fled for the relative freedom of the north, they used chants taught while working in the fields to pass along and remember routes and explain how to use the stars to navigate at night. And as it turns out, this humble little tongue twister about selling seashells by the seashore is yet another example. So first, out of curiosity, does anyone know the secret story behind this tongue twister? One, did a little research back there? Okay, so the she, in this case, turns out to be a girl named Mary. Mary Anning, and we should all know that name. Mary Anning was born in the final months of the 18th century, August of 1799, a time far more different from now than the ensuing 200 years would seem to allow. The vast majority of the world was still in utter poverty. Few people were educated enough to be considered literate, and most of the West still had only the Bible to rely on for its understanding of the history of the world, and so believed it to be perhaps a few thousand years old. Scientifically speaking, Darwin was still 6 decades away from publishing his ideas, and so almost everyone believed that humans were created or descended from Adam and Eve, and that all the world's creatures had just been created as we knew them in the Garden of Eden by God. It's a pretty different time, let alone no indoor plumbing, electricity, cars, TV, and a little something I like to call the iPhone. But Mary Anning was born in southwest England to a family that belonged to the dissenting church, which would eventually become the Congregationalists, and even later here in the United States, the Unitarians. And the dissenter church stressed the importance of education for boys and girls alike, and so despite her family's poverty and her gender, through her church, she was taught to read and write. Now, besides being members of the dissenter congregation, there was one other really important thing about where Mary Anning was born. Down the road from her house in Lyme Regis, along the beach, there were giant limestone cliffs loaded with what we now call fossils. And like many poor families in the area, Mary's family mined these fossils to sell as curios to the rich tourists who came to the beach to escape the city. Despite it being very dangerous work, her father often took her down to the cliffs, especially after rainstorms, which meant both that new fossils would be exposed, but also that the cliffs were at their most precarious. And indeed, after complications from a fall off of one of those cliffs, her father died when she was 11. And out of financial necessity, Mary and her remaining family made a concerted effort at this time to professionalize their work extracting fossils. It was one thing to collect lots of the little ammonites and belemnites, which they called snake stones and devil fingers, and could sell for a few coins. But the real money was to be had with a big and complete vertebra find. And so that is what Mary Anning began to focus on. And so she began studying on her own at the age of 11, everything that was known about fossils in her time, ordering books from far-off libraries and subscribing to science magazines and journals not normally requested by unschooled, not even teenagers. And through incredible determination, hard work, and persistence, Mary Anning turned herself into the best dinosaur hunter of her time. In fact, in many ways, she was the first modern dinosaur hunter who used science instead of luck to lead her to discoveries. When she was 12 years old, her brother dug up an ichthyosaurus skull, fully intact, and over the next few months, using what she was learning about paleontology, she unearthed the first ever complete body of an ichthyosaurus platodon. Soon, other finds followed. And a decade later, she discovered the first plesiosaurus, and 5 years after that, the first flying reptile, a petrosaur. These discoveries were big deals. Big enough to get the attention not just of the most avid curio hunters in the world, but of the academic community as well. Because it was obvious that Mary was unearthing the skeletons of creatures that not only didn't look like anything currently alive, but did kind of look like prototypes of many things we did know. She was rocking the scientific community with her discoveries, helping both to forward a very minority opinion that extinctions of species had occurred in the past, and giving early credence to the truly revolutionary idea that perhaps species we knew now, perhaps even humans, evolved from other creatures no longer with us. Very different world. But again, this was the early 1800s. Women still lacked the right to vote or even to attend university. The same went with the Geological Society of London, who didn't allow women as members or even to attend their meetings. So even though she was far more educated in the field than just about any other living human being, it was again and again the rich men she sold her hard-earned finds to who officially reported them and got the credit for their discoveries. When she was diagnosed in her mid-40s with breast cancer, there was some attempt by the larger scientific community to raise money for her care, but she never in her life was afforded the respect she deserved for her incredible contributions to our understanding of evolution and the natural world. As one of her friends recorded in her journal, "The world has used her ill. These men of learning have sucked her brains and made a great deal of publishing works of which she furnished the contents, while she derived none of the advantages." About a century after her death, her story was rediscovered and made popular by several writers who crafted overly romanticized novels based on her life. But none had the staying power of the tongue twister created in her honor in 1908 that school children and adults still practice to this day. So now you know that those seashells that she sold by the seashore were more than just shells. They were fossils, and she was trying to show us a window into our world's history, persisting through a world hostile to her contributions merely because of her gender. When I encountered this story, it struck me as yet another sad example of how hard it is for female-bodied people to get the credit they deserve, no matter how hard they work, how important their contribution, or how long they persist. And while this story happened a little over 200 years ago, it still has far too many echoes to our present day. In the 21st century, we are still fighting all these same issues. Many of us watched in horror as the first female-identified presidential candidate of a major party was held to a standard unlike any candidate before her, both by voters and her opponents. To make matters worse, we cringed when her opponent, a man who showed blatant disrespect to women at every turn, was rewarded with an electoral victory. Say what you want about either candidate's fitness for the presidency, it was impossible to view this past election as anything but a painful reminder of how far we yet have to go in our struggle for gender equality. But not even that, perhaps, could prepare us for the moment a few months ago that has truly come to symbolize everything about where we are in this struggle and supplied it with its modern battle cry. The scene was a Capitol Hill hearing room, and the cast was the United States Senate, which was currently holding a hearing on the nomination of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. Boo, hiss. At the conclusion of her vehement speech opposing the nomination, the senior senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, began reading into the record a letter written by Coretta Scott King, wife of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, originally written in 1986 to oppose the then nomination of Jeff Sessions, boo hiss, to the federal appellate court. As Senator Warren began reading the speech, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell used an obscure and seldom cited rule to end her time at the microphone prematurely. When Warren protested and attempted to continue to read the letter into the record, Senator McConnell silenced her microphone and uttered the words that would launch a million memes. She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted. Words that echoed through history. Words that women had heard from men for millennia. Words familiar to Mary Anning and Ruby Bridges and so many others. She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted. Pretty sad. Not sad that there's a clear pattern in history of strong women who fight on for equality no matter the odds. No, that makes me hopeful. But that the story sounds so familiar to us still to this day is what is so upsetting. While it's wonderful to be inspired by these women, it's long past time when this kind of heroic should be called for. In 2017, for a woman to be silenced on the floor of the Senate, to be paid 80 cents for every dollar a man makes for the same work, to be at risk for sexual assault simply by going to college is inexcusable. I know that everyone in this room yearns for another world. A world where people are no longer judged by their gender or the color of their skin or by their socioeconomic status, but by the content of their character and their willingness to do what is right. But yearning is not enough. We cannot be another generation who writes beautiful songs inspired by the women leading the struggle for gender equality. No. We must get off of our good intentions and step into the effort as if it is a spiritual calling, because it is. As Unitarian Universalists who affirm the inherent worth and dignity of all people, we must step up our commitment to disrupting the patriarchy that keeps all people of any gender identity, from being able to be their full selves. Because we all participate in these structures and systems. It lives in the way we raise our children to speak more if they are boys and listen more if they are girls. It lives in the books, TV shows, and movies we watch as an obsession with male heroes and female victims. It lives in the way we hire and compensate in the office with male bodies at the top of the org chart and women at the bottom getting paid less than those men at their same level. Each and every one of us has an opportunity, should we choose to take advantage of it, at times at some risk to ourselves, to disrupt this system. And the truth is, actually, as I think Megan put it so well, oftentimes all it takes is a question to begin the disruption. Questions are more powerful than we think, because this inequality thrives on secrecy and can only live in silence. So merely asking out loud in a meeting why salaries are the way they are at your company will force people to think and act. Just asking the question. Merely asking a teacher why they call on the students they do will force that teacher to think about it, perhaps for the first time. Merely asking your child what they are learning about gender roles from the media they are consuming will invite them to consider things consciously that they were previously taking in unconsciously. However you choose to participate in the disruption of the patriarchy, let us no longer be a people that pass on the stories of our brave women in secret. Let us be a people that take the risks this world requires to move us to a time when all of us, can finally be seen as equal. May it be so. Amen.